Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by MTC Kitchen, Mutual Trading Company's online store.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond the sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Todd Bellamy, who is the owner and brewer at Dovetail Sake, which is the first sake brewery in Massachusetts. And Todd has just released his first sake in February. We'll talk about how he got into sake, challenges in making his own sake in the U.S., and much more. Hello, Todd. Welcome to Japanese.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So you studied anthropology first and then studied Japanese language at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst. So how did you become interested in Japanese language and culture?
I grew up in a very small town in Maine, about 2,000 people. Mm-hmm. So I was always, and I think everyone of my age was always looking outside of the town, mm-hmm. Looking far afield and elsewhere. And I just spent a lot of time in books. So mm-hmm. You know, growing up in a very small town, I didn't know any Japanese people, but for some reason I was very fascinated by Japan and Japanese history. And it all just came from books.
Okay, interesting. And so after learning Japanese, you moved to Japan, which is interesting.
Yeah. It wasn't quite as successful as that. I was a full-time cook in a restaurant to be able to pay for college, and eventually, like many people who work full-time to pay for college, I got to a point where it was really difficult to work full-time in a kitchen and pay for school and have the time to do the work. So very close to graduation, maybe two or three semesters away, I just stopped going to school and went to Japan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was just so fed up with not being able to just get traction that I just went to Japan.
And then I heard you worked at the sword maker as an apprentice.
I did, yeah. That is certainly one of the things that sticks out on my resume the most. I've studied martial arts ever since I was a little kid, and I was really interested in martial arts, and that was always in the background of no matter what I did, whether it was interested in food or you know, beverages. But I always studied martial arts, so I just got it in my head at some point. I think the desire to just get out of my situation where I was in kind of a rut and just get out in any way I could. I just thought, wow, it would be really cool to see this other side of Japan. I went and I spent a little under a year as a sword making apprentice.
But how did you find the job?
Yeah, actually, what I did, there certainly was an internet back then, but it wasn't as prolific as it is now. So I wrote I forget his name, in California, and he mailed me a catalog from the sort of the Japan Sword Making Society. And in the back of the book, it was a sort of catalog of their yearly show. And in the back of the book were the names and addresses of all the licensed kaji, sword makers in Japan. So I did what anybody would do. I wrote a letter in Japanese with the help of some friends of mine. And certainly, you know, I'd been studying Japanese. So I wrote a letter and I copied it 248 times. And I mailed it to all 248 wow. swordsmiths in Japan. Yeah.
So one of them responded.
Yeah. Thank God. Actually, 10 people responded. Mm. I still have the letters at home. 8 were negative responses. Mm. 7 were negative responses. One person had actually passed away, and his daughter had written me back. And then 2 guys responded. One guy said, well, just move to Japan and get a job and an apartment and then come see me, which seemed just insurmountably, you know, just insurmountable at that point. And then the teacher that I actually ended up spending some time with said, look, I don't have a lot of money and I can't pay you. And frankly, you're probably going to live in like a prefabricated tool shed. But if you can get here, I'll, you know, train you and you'll help me out. And I can give you a place to sleep and rice.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's what I did. I just packed up my stuff and went.
Mm, and what did you learn?
I learned a lot of stuff I didn't expect to. It was a very small village. So there were only about 100 people in the village in northern Saitama.
Mm-hmm. Which is next prefecture, Tokyo, but it's very suburb.
Yeah, it was very mountainous and rural. About 100 people in the village. A lot of people in the village had the same last name. so everyone had nicknames, which was very entertaining. But I got to see this side of Japan that I think not a lot of people get to see. Mm. There were some people there who I'm not sure have seen a big, bald, white guy up close.
Right.
You know? So, yeah. So it was very interesting. And certainly for language development, there was no English at all.
No choice.
So it was either learn Japanese or just don't say anything, which actually, I think I learned a lot of patience out of that.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And then how did you get into sake?
So before I left, growing up in New England, but also, you know, just living in New England that whole time, craft beer was sort of on its first upswing. Mm-hmm. We're now sort of in its second resurgence. But during the early 90s, there was a lot of craft beer. And so I found myself interested in beer, and I knew something about making beer at home and things like that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I was in Japan for a while that I started realizing that the sake that they were giving us mm-hmm. was all really, really good. Even the first glass of sake I had was the night I got to Japan, and they gave it to me in a coffee cup.
Mm. So there was a what kind of occasion? What you said, a class or when the first time you had sake?
Yeah, so I went to study sword making, mm-hmm. And the first night I was there, so I went and I met Shiso-san, the person I would study under, and he poured. He had another student mm-hmm. and a wife and a small child, and he poured me a cup of sake in a coffee mug.
Oh wow!
And I thought, all right, whatever, you know, it's just a cup. So I drank it, and up until then, at least in the United States, I'd only had sake that wasn't very good. Mm. And so I drank this sake out of this coffee cup, and I thought, wow, this is really amazing. Mm. And I thought it was some special kind of sake. But the more I lived in Japan, the more I realized that it was all that good. Mm. It's just that we didn't have access to it here.
Right.
Yeah. And then I started to slowly fall in love with it.
Mm. Okay. And I'm sure you had a lot of sake. So other than sword making, what did you do in Japan?
Yeah. So after I was a sword maker for a while, I tried to be a sword making apprentice very late in life. So I was in my late 20s. Mm. You have to study and live very poorly for about 10 years to be a sword maker. And so I just started to realize that it probably wasn't going to be a realistic choice for someone who's almost 30. Mm. And so my teacher was very understanding, very nice guy. But I was already in Japan, so it was much easier to get a job and move around in Japan. Mm-hmm. So I got some jobs teaching English to children and housewives, and I also taught children science in English.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so we got to do science experiments and things like that. So I actually liked that job more than I thought I would. I never saw myself as a teacher or anything like that, but it was a very easy job to get, and the pay was really, really good. So it allowed me to stay in Japan and have a great deal of free time.
Mm. So yeah. What made you to change, you know, not to stay in Japan and come back to the States?
Yeah, mostly that was my wife, who is my wife now, but was my girlfriend at the time. She was in grad school in Texas, and we were trying to live apart. It just seemed like a good time for me to go to Japan for a while. So so we were doing the long-distance relationship thing, and that got kind of tiring. And I would have been really overjoyed if she wanted to move to Japan, but that's a lot to ask for somebody who doesn't speak Japanese or anything. So she certainly loves to visit, but to ask somebody to live there permanently is a pretty big step. So I moved back after about, you know, just under 4 years in Japan.
Okay. Yeah. So that was when you developed your interest and deepened your interest in sake.
Yeah, I actually got interested in beer. I met a man after I moved out of Saitama. I moved to Shizuoka for a little bit, I met a man named Brian Baird who had just started Baird Brewing. It was a small brew pub operation, and I sort of had reaffirmed my love of sort of brewing, and I talked to him a lot about brewing and got interested. So when I got back from Japan, I started homebrewing beer more frequently, but it didn't take very long before I started missing sake.
Okay.
I had been in the thick of it in Japan for so long that I didn't realize that when I went back to America, I would miss things like sake.
Because it's not available. The good sake isn't available.
Yeah, back then especially, it was not available at all. Right. Unless I came down here to New York or something like that. Yeah.
Okay, so then gradually you started to think of opening your own brewery, sake brewery?
Yeah, actually, so... I knew a little bit about sake brewing. I'd seen some stuff in Japan, but I didn't study it by any stretch of the imagination. So I actually went online and found the Jozo Kyokai, the Japanese Brewers Guild, and they had a fleet of books available on their website.
Okay.
So I ordered their books from their website. They're, you know, textbooks for brewing, for professional brewing. Home brewing still is illegal in Japan, so there aren't a lot of books on home brewing, hardly any. But these professional books were available.
In Japanese.
In Japanese, right. Yeah. So I got the books. You know, my Japanese was pretty good at the time, and obviously with a dictionary and enough time, you can do anything.
Right.
So the books are written for 1,500-liter batches, which is a little big for my house. So I scaled everything down from 1,500 liters to 25 liters and just did the math, scaled it down, and then started making sake.
Oh, wow.
At home, yeah. Mm.
Was it easy?
You know what? I had been homebrewing beer for a while, so I already had some equipment. And it wasn't that bad, actually, on that scale. Mm-hmm. You know, you're only making it in a 5-gallon bucket. And I was surprised. A lot of people want to hear this horror story about brewing. but the first batch of sake that I made in my kitchen was actually pretty good. I mean, it wasn't as good as my sake now, but it was identifiable as sake and it was drinkable.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you gained the confidence then.
Yeah. Right. I gained a little confidence and then that allowed me to read more of the books and start making better and better sake.
Right. And then you worked for Boston Brewery, which is a producer of Sam Adams, for 8 years. So did it help to start when you...
I think so. I think I certainly got into the company at a really interesting time. They were experiencing this very fast growth. And I took the job. It wasn't the position. The position exactly wasn't what I wanted to do. But I really wanted to work at a brewery. And I wanted to kind of get my foot in the door. And I was told by some friends and some colleagues that worked in the brewing industry, oh, you should go and get your foot in the door. And then who knows what could happen. But I got the job at the time when the company was experiencing very, very fast growth. And they still are. And so I got a lot of exposure to stuff, especially other brewers and things like that. But I wasn't allowed to just move around inside the company and do whatever I wanted. And ultimately, that's, you know, the reason I left is because I wanted to make something. I just didn't want to sit at a desk.
Right.
Yeah.
But in the culture of brewing, you were immersed in it.
Yeah, in the culture. And certainly the first 4 years that I worked at the Boston Beer Company, I got a lot of exposure because I worked at their small brewery in Boston. So I got a lot of exposure to brewing. brewers and like working in a lab and meeting people. My manager that I had for a number of years had been working in the beer industry for 25 years, and she was very knowledgeable. So, you know, it certainly was a great experience, and to learn a lot about launching your own brand, spending 8 years at the Boston Beer Company was a pretty formative experience for me.
Right. Yeah. Like more management side.
Yeah, I mean, everything. I mean, it was a big company that they were doing a lot of stuff, but it was a small enough company where you could still walk into the owner's office and just chat.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And then you had a more intense experience as an intern at Asahi Shuzo Sake Brewing Company in Yamaguchi Prefecture.
Right.
And how was the experience?
Oh, it was great. I've actually been to Japan twice to specifically work in breweries. Mm. So the first time was 2009. I was introduced to the owners of Asahi Shuzo, or Dasai, mm-hmm. is their sake, through George Cao. Who used to work for Mutual Trading Company, now mm-hmm. works for Sun Noodle. But when George was working for Mutual Trading Company, we met at some sake events.
Mm-hmm. And George is super knowledgeable and passionate about sake.
He's so knowledgeable and passionate about sake and very eager to share education. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I was in the beer industry, but really interested in sake and doing a lot of sake things on the weekends. And so I met George, and he introduced me to the Sakudai family who own Dasai. Yes, and he arranged for me to go for a week. So I went to Japan for a couple of weeks, but spent the first week working at Asahi Shuzo, which was amazing. Mm. It's an amazing brewery. It was really eye-opening, because the learning that I had done until then was all books. Mm. And these books are brewing textbooks for professionals, so there's not even any photographs in them. So it was interesting to see the brewing up close, especially in such a great setting. They're in this tiny village that still has monkeys living in the forest. I stayed really close to the brewery where the family lives, right. And got to see sake brewing up close, especially at such a high level. Mm. It was really amazing experience.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, well, listeners go to, you know, like Japanese restaurants in New York City, you can see Dasai brand, and they're very open-minded, and I think you're not the first intern from outside Japan.
Yeah, they've actually been pretty open with their brewery, and they've had a number of foreigners go and study and make, help make sake there to have some hands-on experience, which is invaluable if you're going to make sake or make anything at that point. But especially sake, you have to go there and work in a brewery and just see and kind of feel what they're doing every day. Mm. It would be very hard to do it without doing that.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you opened Dovetail Sake in February 2014. And what is your philosophy of sake making?
Actually? Yeah, in February 2014, we started R&D. We started research and development. I met my business partner, Daniel Krupp, and he and I sort of joined forces and decided we were both developing breweries on our own. Hmm. And then we met at a sake event that I was hosting, and we were just thinking, you know, Boston's a great area, but it's certainly not big enough to support two sake breweries. So we joined forces. He's a really great, you know, he sort of takes more of an owner role, and I'm the brewer. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of joined forces, and our philosophy is really simple. We're two boys from New England, so we're not Japanese, if you didn't notice. So we're not Japanese, so we're not trying to be Japanese. So our brand is very New England-centric. But our philosophy is basically we want people to drink it because it's delicious and not because it's sake. Mm. You know, certainly people will come to us because they love sake or they're Japanophiles. But we want people to just drink it because it's a delicious handmade beverage. Mm. And so we look to traditional Japanese brewing, but we're not limited by that. Mm. So if there's something that we can do and it makes the sake taste better, we're going to do it, whether it's traditional to do it that way or not. We try to keep a pretty open mind. Mm. And just really, quality is the most important aspect.
Right.
Without a quality sake, it doesn't matter how good your brand is or your label is or how cool your t-shirts are or whatever. Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. But fundamentally, you really follow the traditional stylish.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I don't think you'll see a lot of stuff from us that's not at least grounded in tradition. You know, I don't plan to sort of, you know, there have been some people around the country that have tried to take a beer approach with sake, so age sake on in bourbon barrels or fruit or something like that. I don't really see us doing that. Americans don't really understand that much about sake, so the incredible depth of knowledge and styles and all the variation is new to everybody.
Right.
That we encounter, right? Most people that we encounter, all of this is brand new. So I could plumb the depths of Japanese sake brewing for decades, and it's all new to everybody.
Mm.
Yeah. So right. Why, you know, do something that may or may not work?
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's fun for you, probably. Mm. You can just try out different things.
Yeah, without a doubt. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about Todd's first sake that has just released to the market. So please stay with us.
Mutual Trading Kitchen is run by New York Mutual Trading, a premier specialist for wholesale Japanese food and restaurant supplies since 1926. They're a one-stop shop for all your Japanese culinary needs. They have a range of quality Japanese knives, sharpening stones, kitchenware, tableware, and shelf-stable food, and are conveniently located in Midtown Manhattan near Grand Central Station. Although they specialize in wholesale distribution, this venue is open to the public, and they showcase artisan tableware that is only available in the showroom. Check out their website at mtckitchen.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Todd Bellamy, who is the owner and brewer at Dovetail Sake, which is the first sake brewery built in Massachusetts. Todd has just released his first sake in February. So, for listeners who are not familiar with sake making process, could you give us like a 30 seconds version of how to make sake?
Sure, because it's that easy. Sake is alcohol made from grain, so it actually shares more in common with beer than it does a wine. I know people call sake rice wine. It's not.
Mm.
Sake is just sake. So you basically, to make any alcohol, you need sugar. Winemakers can just crush grapes and the grapes are sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Beer makers actually have a company that will malt the grain and turn it into sugar.
Mm.
So for sake, you use two methods to make rice all the way into sake. You use a fungus called koji,
mm-hmm.
Which is a very common fungus in the food making industry. That actually excretes enzymes that converts the rice into sugar.
Mm.
So you get starches being converted into sugar. And then you have yeast that ferments the sugar into alcohol.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the quick version of it.
That's the quick version, I'm
right.
Sorry.
So the key is it's not wine and similar to beer, but it's not the same.
That's exactly,
right.
Yeah.
Okay, so to produce high-quality sake, what kind of ingredients do you use?
Yeah, the coolest thing about sake is it's very simple and very natural. We use water and high-quality brewing rice, yeast, obviously, and then koji that we grow ourselves, and that's it. There's no other, there's no chemical preservatives or anything like that.
Mm.
So luckily in Massachusetts, we have very high quality water from the Quabbin Reservoir, which is in the western part of Massachusetts.
Mm.
So we filter the water that comes out of the tap at our brewery just to remove anything and have a blank slate.
Mm, but think the Japanese water tend to be softer than here.
Japan actually has some very interesting water profiles because of the volcanism and the soil structure is very different than from here. So some place like Niigata, which is very well known for soft sake, has very, very soft water.
Mm.
And the trend in modern sake brewing certainly is to go soft and dry. But there are areas of Japan with very, very hard water. But the hallmark of sake brewing water, whether it's hard or soft, is that it contains zero iron. Mm. You don't want iron in your brewing water. It discolors your sake. It gives you off flavors in your sake. So that's one of the reasons we also filter the water to make it a blank slate, so that especially there's no iron. Mm. And then we can always add back anything to the water that we need. Mm. If the water needs a little calcium or a little phosphate, we can just add that.
Wow. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. So what about the rice? Because the rice, you know, it's not like Californian eating rice. Sake needs right. Sake rice, right?
Yeah, normally. Some small brewers in the United States are actually using eating rice, like Koshi Hikari, which is a very famous sushi rice. Mm. We had settled on a rice called Hitome Bore, which is an eating rice, but it's also used to make sake in Japan.
Mm-hmm. That means loving the first sight.
Right. And so it's used for both in Japan, eating and making sake. So it was the closest thing we could get. And we had already chose the rice and bought a bag of it. And then I got a phone call in August that Yamada Nishiki, sort of the king of all sake making rices, it's the most popular sake brewing rice in the world, was actually available in the United States for the first time.
Wow.
So we halted brewing. We were very close to starting full-time brewing. Mm. And we actually just kind of pumped the brakes a little bit and then got some test Yamada Nishiki so that we could make small batches to test it out.
Right.
And we're so blown away with the quality difference that we decided just to go all Yamada Nishiki.
Wow. Where is it grown?
It's grown in Arkansas
by
a single farmer, and then it gets shipped to a rice mill in Minnesota, Minnesota Rice and Milling. And then they mill it down to our specifications, which is 60%. So 40% of the rice has been removed, and then they get shipped to us.
Mm.
Yeah.
So that's called the Ginjo
grade. Ginjo grade, yeah. We don't use the word Ginjo currently on our sake, but it is a Junmai Ginjo.
Mm, right. Yeah. So at least 40% is milled down. It's called the Ginjo.
Right.
And 50% is called Dai Ginjo.
Right.
Right. So, and I just wanted to tell our listeners that sake rice is still different because it's the grain is larger because you want to have a big starch so that you can survive, the milling.
Eating rice, all your macronutrients, your starches and your proteins and your fats are all mixed together, which is what you want in an eating rice. You don't want to cook the rice and then somehow not get protein or fat. But sake brewing rice has the starches concentrated at the center of the rice grain, so that allows you to mill away the outside, which is predominantly protein and fat, and get those out of the way to make a cleaner brew.
Right.
Yeah.
And also, I heard that the center part called the shinpaku, that's the porous, so the bacteria grows easily.
Oh, yeah. It absorbs water very easily and then, makes it, once the inside is kind of soft and squishy, it can be attacked very easily by your yeast and your koji.
Mm. Yeah. Right. So I didn't know that Yamada Nishiki grows in Arkansas, so that's a good
thing. Yeah, actually, it's pretty great. It's the only farmer that I know of in North America who's growing Yamada Nishiki. Mm. So we checked, and I'm pretty sure that we're the only sake brewery in North America who is just going all Yamada Nishiki or all high-grade brewing rice. Mm-hmm. I think everyone else, other small brewers might make a single sake or maybe two batches of sake during the year with Yamada Nishiki, like a special sake, but we are just using it for everything because it's just such an amazing, amazing rice.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, congratulations.
Thank you.
Good timing, too.
Thanks, yeah.
Right. And so you just released your first sake. And what types of sake do you make, and why did you choose that types?
We decided to brew two styles to launch the brand. So we're brewing two styles. One is called Nakahama Junmai, named after Nakahama Manjiro, who's the first Japanese person to live in America.
Mm.
He lived in Fairhaven, Massachusetts. And so we named our sake after him. It's a Junmai Ginjo, technically, but because sake is new to everybody, we decided that we would only use one vocabulary word per style.
Mm.
So I didn't want to put out a sake and have it be, this is technically a Nama Junmai Ginjo, right? Mm-hmm. It's unpasteurized Junmai Ginjo. Mm-hmm. But that's a lot for someone to learn off, you know, out of the gates. Okay. And so we just called it Junmai. Junmai means pure rice.
Mm-hmm. No fortified.
Right. No, it's not fortified. We don't add any alcohol or anything mm-hmm. else. And the word Junmai really evokes what, you know, this sake is. It's pure and clean and mm-hmm. filtered. And then we made a Nigori sake, which is unfiltered, mm-hmm. Called Omori Nigori, mm-hmm. Named after an archaeological site in Japan that was discovered by a man from Maine. So another New Englander, having an effect on Japan. So we have our Nigori, which is not a cloudy version of this sake. It's a completely different sake, different recipe. It has a different yeast strain, so it's very, very different.
Mm. So it's unfiltered, and mm-hmm. then it's cloudy looking?
Yeah, cloudy looking. It's unfiltered. It's, you know, partial. We take out some of the solids, so it's not extremely chunky, but it has a lot of white solids left in it. So you're supposed to shake the bottle a little bit before you drink it, and the sake is completely white.
Right. And the Nigori tend to be sweeter.
Yeah. This sake, the Nakahama Junmai, is sort of medium dry sake. And our Nigori is exactly what you'd want. It's sweet and round and big and fruity mm-hmm. and kind of fun.
Right, you know? And mouthfeel.
Yeah. Actually, I wasn't sure if we were going to make a Nigori to begin with, but Americans really love Nigori sake. Mm. Japanese people drink it, but not so much. Right. it's a fringe style in Japan, but Americans drink a lot of unfiltered sake. Mm. So we thought it was a good fit.
Because of maybe you taste more lactic acid and you feel familiar? Or
yeah, I'm not really sure. Sorry, I'm opening a bottle.
Okay.
I'm not sure why Americans love it so much, but, you know, it's analogous to the fact that Americans also attach themselves to sushi as the predominant Japanese food in America.
Mm.
It's sort of the most alien food. You know, there certainly are foods in Japan that are not that alien at all. I mean, grilled chicken on a stick, you know, yakitori or something like that, is very approachable. But we didn't latch on to what was approachable. We latched on to the most alien thing out there, sushi, uncooked fish on vinegared rice and everything. I think Nigori sake is the same way.
Right.
You know, people look at sake and they're like, oh, this looks like a white wine or something like that. So maybe it's a little too familiar looking. Mm. So Nigori sake, they're like, oh, it's white. It's crazy looking. It looks like milk. I think those two are probably linked in some way.
Mm. Yeah. So now in my hand, there's a glass of beautiful Junmai.
Yeah.
Nakahama Junmai. And this is the color slightly yellower. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Sake is a really interesting beverage in the fact that if you give somebody else another kind of beverage, like a beer or something like that, from the color and sort of the heft of it in the glass, you can kind of tell what you're getting into.
Mm.
But with sake, it's so alien where you look at it, it's slightly off-colored water, basically.
Mm.
And people look at it and they don't know what to expect. And then you drink it, and there's this explosion of flavor and layers of flavor. Our sake in particular, Nakahama Junmai, has a lot of tropical fruit flavors like mango and pineapple mm-hmm. and melon. And then there's some layers of spice, especially.
Yeah, I think it's the sancho pepper.
Oh, yeah. Right. A lot of people, there's like a peppery spice. We use two yeast strains in this particular sake. One of them produces a lot of a chemical called ethyl caproate,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a fresh fennel or anise note, which is often found in high-grade sake. So we use that yeast strain specifically to give it that note.
And there's a nose is a little more like caramel, mm-hmm. like a butterscotch.
Yeah. Sake is very complex
and
delicious.
Mm. So what kind of food would you recommend with this Junmai?
Everyone wants to go to sushi, but for me, I really, really love sake and grilled meats.
Mm.
So anything that I take off my grill, whether it's grilled chicken or a hamburger or a steak or something like that, that's my first stop when pairing food with sake. But you know, seeing as that we live in Boston, we're not, you know, certainly in Japan, it's for me, it's sake is so food friendly. It goes with almost anything. This sake I've had with everything between, you know, pizza and tacos and a cheese plate and things like that. It just goes well with everything.
Yeah, I was thinking of like grilled cod fillet. Because it's the flakiness and the creaminess goes well with the sake.
Yeah, I could say. I mean, luckily we're in Boston, so we have great produce and meats from the western side of the state. And then, you know, obviously we're right on the Atlantic Ocean, so amazing seafood. This is great with raw oysters or a lobster roll in the summer.
Yeah. So where can we get your sake?
Yeah, currently, so we're about 2 weeks away from launching bottles of our sake. Currently, when you're in Boston, you can only get it on draft at one place.
That is cool. Like right next to craft beer, you have sake.
Yeah, it's the Cambridge Brewing Company, which is One Kendall Square in Cambridge. They're really good friends of ours, and they've been very supportive over the years. I promised them a long time ago that they could be our first draft account. So we're actually talking with several other restaurants about putting sake on draft. And then once bottles come out in a couple of weeks, I think we'll obviously, you know, it'll be in stores and restaurants all over the Boston area.
Well, hopefully it's going to come to New York soon.
Yeah, soon. We'll see. Probably in a year or two. We're going to focus on our local market, you know, because we're a very small brewery. Right now it's only two people. So we're just going to focus on our local market and see Boston and Cambridge and Somerville. Massachusetts, you know, has such a great food scene that it's really a great pairing. You know, we have a lot of people asking us to, you know, wanting to buy our sake that are not necessarily Japanese restaurants. You know, they're barbecue places and really farm-to-table oriented restaurants and things like that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's not uncommon to find sake in French restaurant or New American restaurant, so that really makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, what are the biggest challenges making sake on your own in Boston? Like, it can be, like, for instance, I was thinking, you know, you have to have a license, which is the same as a winery license.
Actually, we're a brewery. Because we make alcohol from grain, we're not a winery at all. So we have a brewing permit from the federal government and the state. All of that stuff was actually not the hardest part. Obviously, the hardest part is not second-guessing yourself. So I have a lot of book knowledge, and I have some brewing experience from going to Japan and things like that. But when you're actually the brewer and you're actually calling all the shots, the hardest part is just not second guessing yourself, you know, to go with your heart and say, this is what we're doing and this is the way to go. Especially when you get all that rice in the tank. You know, it's 650 pounds of rice, give or take, in a tank. That's an awful lot of rice to just say, okay, we're just going to do this and it's going to work out fine.
Right.
Yeah. So far, so good.
Well, if you didn't do it, you would really regret. So.
Yeah. I was getting kind of old. That was, you know, one of the things that I thought is I have to leave my desk job, the safety of my desk job, and open a sake brewery, because that's really what I want to do. And if I don't do it now, it's just going to get harder and harder to do it as I get older.
And you'd be sadder and sadder.
I would always wonder, would that have worked out? Would it have not worked out? So far, it's working out.
Great. And so what's most rewarding in making sake on your own?
You know, when you make sake, there's two things that really kind of get me out of bed in the morning, besides my wife kicking me, is that the first thing is it's really great to take all of these disparate parts. You know, you've got rice and clean water and koji that I've grown myself and yeast and all this, and then you put it into a tank and you get the conditions just right, and the yeast is the one that actually does all the work. I'm just like a yeast rancher. I don't really make sake. The yeast makes the sake. So I just create this perfect environment for the yeast and the koji to thrive, and lo and behold, out the other side comes this really beautiful beverage. The other thing that I'm starting to really, really enjoy is, all, you know, unlike beer, all of my consumers are very new to sake. So it's really such a great pleasure to give somebody a glass of sake. They have no clue what it is. Mm. They don't know what it's going to taste like or what it's going to smell like or the experience. And then they drink it and they're mostly they are blown away by how complex it is and delicate. And it's really great to see that over and over. It's like just getting, you know, could you imagine selling beer and giving everyone their first beer? That's right. What it's like. You know? It's right. Really cool.
Because, you know, education to me, I mean, it sounds like you really like educating people about sake.
I do, yeah. I do. It's a great beverage. It's so friendly. It's so food friendly. It has way less acid than something like a wine. Mm. And it has a very different suite of acids. You know, it doesn't have these harsh acids like citric acid and malic acid like wines do. It has lactic acid and these really soft acids that are really delicious with a variety of foods.
Right. Okay. And is it easier to, you know, maybe you can bring your own sake and then look, you have to try this.
Yeah.
You can educate people more.
It's nice. It's been really nice being able to go somewhere and just grab a bottle of my sake out of the fridge.
Right. Yeah. And I think there are about 10 non-Japanese sake breweries in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So how do you predict the future of sake making in this country?
You know, I hope that all the sake breweries, they seem to, so far, everyone is really sticking to a mindset of it's got to be high quality. Mm-hmm. And I think what's going to happen is it's going to allow consumers to get access to the actual makers of the beverage. Mm-hmm. I love Japanese breweries, and they're some of our best friends. Certainly, some of our most supportive friends of our breweries are other Japanese breweries, like Kikusui Brewing in Niigata. I went there to study as well, and they've been very supportive. But, you know, even a big company like Kikusui, they only have a handful of people outside of Japan selling sake. So what it's going to do for the whole category, I think, is it's going to allow consumers to have access to the people who are making it and get a lot more education and a lot more experience with what sake is.
Mm, and people can see how it's made.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, we have a very small brewery now, but our next space will have space for a tasting room and things like that. So people will be able to come and see us make it. Mm. Right now, it's a very, very small space, and I'm a big guy. So there's no space for anybody else to really be in there. But our next space will definitely have, tour space and tasting room and things like that. People can come buy sake from us and taste it on premises and see how it's made. But those experiences are going to be invaluable to growing the whole category. Mm. So for me, yeah, I want to grow our company, and I want people to drink fresher and fresher sake. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the other big thing, is that our sake is going 6 miles, not 6,000 miles. No matter how good of a brewer you are in Japan, you know, your sake is still going to go 6,000 miles and sit in a warehouse somewhere. So this bottle that we're enjoying today, I filled yesterday.
Oh, wow.
You know, so you can't really beat that. So I'm not, you know, are we as good as a sake brewery that's 1,000 years old in Japan? Probably not yet. But also, I can just do things like fill a bottle and drink it the next day.
Right.
So really amazing, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I look for more breweries coming up in this country.
Yeah, I hope so. There are several. There's some in Seattle, San Francisco. There's one in Maine, Toronto. There's one in British Columbia. There's two in British Columbia. So they're cropping up. There's one in Texas. Minneapolis, obviously, is the home of the only sake brew pub in the country. So they're cropping up, and they're being successful mostly. So it's exciting to see.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. And I heard you have worked on a very interesting project with Cambridge Brewing Company that you mentioned earlier, and which is to make a hybrid of beer and sake. So
yeah, we've made several batches in the past. Now that I have our own brand, Dovetail Sake, it's a little more complex to how we're going to make the hybrid between the two breweries. So we're trying to figure out the right and legal way to do it. But basically, I met Will Myers, the head brewer at Cambridge Brewing Company, years ago, and while I was in the beer industry, and we became really good friends. And he didn't know anything about sake. So we started talking about sake and drinking sake together. And we started talking about how it's made. And Will is a very sort of loving, sort of organic brewer, and he loves, you know, he doesn't like to do things like flavor beers. He likes everything to be part of the organic process. So I think some people would have taken like beer and sake and blended them together. Mm-hmm. But for Will, he was like, how do we take the two processes and meld them and make a hybrid product? So we experimented, and then one day we were done experimenting, and he said, let's just make a batch, a whole batch of it. So we made a 500-liter batch of sake at the Cambridge Brewing Company by hand, and then blended that with beer wort and allowed the sake to ferment everything. So we didn't actually use beer yeast. We used a whole tank of sake to inoculate a tank of beer wort.
Oh, wow.
And I've talked to a lot of brewers in Japan and the United States, whether they're beer brewers or sake brewers. And as far as I can tell, no one's really done it besides
never
us.
Heard.
Yeah. It's a really, really unique product. And we've made about five batches or so over the years. It's an arduous task to make it in a small brew pub. But,
right. But how does it taste like? It's the bubbly and also tasty.
You know what? We served it with very little carbonation. We tried it with carbonation and didn't particularly like it. So it was really interesting. You get a lot of sort of grape, fresh grape flavors because of the type of sugar that's in barley that the sake yeast ends up fermenting. But it definitely a very high alcohol. Kind of like a cross between a sake and a barley wine, like a really high alcohol beer,
right.
And had a lot of fruity flavors because of the sake yeast. We actually also made a secondary version where we aged it on sugi wood.
Mm-hmm.
So we ended up calling the beer sake hybrid Bunryu Ichi.
Mm-hmm.
There's an old saying, sake zukuri Bunryu, which means there's 10,000 ways to make sake. Mm-hmm. So we called ours Bunryu Ichi, which means 10,001 ways.
Right.
And then we aged some on sugi wood, which is a Japanese wood, very aromatic, used to age sake.
Mm.
We called it nomisugi,
like.
Which is a play on words. It means to drink too much.
Right.
But we used the character for sugi, which is the wood.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. Never-ending opportunities of sake.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So hopefully we'll do it again. I know Will and I are chomping at the bit to do it again.
Mm.
And who knows? I'd like to figure out a way to make it and bottle it. We've never bottled it. We've only served it on draft at the pub. So I'd really like to find a way of putting it in a bottle so we could get it a little further afield.
Well, I hope so. I'm very curious about it.
It's such a unique product, yeah.
Okay, so thank you for joining us today, Todd. And best of luck, and I hope you'll come back to the show.
Thanks. I'll come back anytime, and thanks for having me.
Okay.
Cheers.
So, listeners, if you have been you're interested in Todd's sake, please visit dovetailsake.com. And you also have the bostonsake.com?
Yeah, it's a blog that I've run for a number of years. We're going to actually start porting some of that stuff over to our website, dovetailsake.com. But there's it's about 6 years, there's an awful lot of content on bostonsake.com that people can go and check out.
That's great. So, okay, bostonsake.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And by the way, we just launched a beautiful new website, so please visit our page. Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher Podcasts. Today's show was made possible by MTC Kitchen, and our engineer is David Tatasiole. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.